President Trump says the U.S. is done fighting wars in the Middle East. But former Defense Secretary Ash Carter says there are consequences for the U.S. turning its back.
What's going to happen, I'm afraid, is that ISIS is going to come back. We're going to have to do it all over again. But next time, we'll be alone.
Also today, Leonardo da Vinci dreamt of building a really, really long bridge. 500 years later, MIT engineers wanted to know if his design could work.
I was incredibly worried until I put the last stones in.
We'll find out if the stones held. And you should definitely visit Norway. Just don't go for the food.
Our food culture is not based on very strong taste at all.
It's a virtue to be bland in Norway. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It is their neighborhood, and they have to take care of it. That's what President Trump had to say about northeastern Syria. Trump says he wants other nations to get involved and that U.S. troops are done there. So what might the region look like without the American military? Ash Carter was Secretary of Defense under President Obama from 2015 to 2017. I asked him how he felt when he saw images this week of U.S. personnel carriers being pelted with rocks and potatoes as they departed from northern Syria.
My heart went out to our guys. It's a terrible thing to put them in this position. This was an incomprehensible surrender of our position and of the people who helped us win. And, you know, if you don't want to be in endless wars, don't lose the wars you've already won.
So President Trump has pulled the U.S. troops out, but there are now reports that the Pentagon has drawn up tentative plans to send 30 Abrams tanks along with half of an Army armored brigade to Syria's oil fields. What do you make of this news?
Well, it's kind of a fallback position. After having done this, to me, incomprehensible move, walking away from the Syrian Kurds and our position in northern Syria, and also green-lighting Turkey to do something it's been asking to do for years, and we've always said no for good reason, this is a fallback position. I don't know how sustainable it is, but I think it arises, I'm guessing, from the Pentagon trying to claw back some sort of position in northeastern Syria despite the president's decision.
I mean, it's clear the leaders of Russia, Turkey, and Syria all want U.S. troops out. President Trump seems especially concerned with Syria's oil. Let's hear this.
We've secured the oil, and therefore a small number of U.S. troops will remain in the area where they have the oil, and we're going to be protecting it, and we'll be deciding what we're going to do with it in the future.
We will be deciding what to do with that oil. I mean, why does President Trump think the U.S. can decide what to do with Syria's oil?
You have a small number of troops in a big place. We might be able to influence something about what's done with the oil there, but we basically just gave up our principal leverage voluntarily to Turkey, to Russia, to the Syrian regime, and to Iran. And I find that incomprehensible.
Ash Carter, one of your main responsibilities during your time as Pentagon chief was combating ISIS. President Trump is trying to reassure us that ISIS cannot rebound.
ISIS is under very, very strict lock and key. And the detention facilities are being strongly maintained. There were a few that got out, a small number, relatively speaking, and they've been largely recaptured.
Well, there are mixed reports on the numbers who have escaped. But Ash Carter, do you think the Pentagon is as confident as President Trump about the future of ISIS?
They certainly have no reason to be as confident as that. These guys have shown before in history, both after 2003 and then after U.S. forces were basically withdrawn from Iraq the first time, they've shown their ability to come back. So ISIS will come back. They'll come back in part through these detainees that the Kurds are now watching and are now less able to protect and have less desire to protect. And then there are some that we never captured or killed. They said they'd fight to the death, and unfortunately, they didn't all. So these guys are fanatics, and if they're not dead, they're waiting for a new opportunity. So what's going to happen, I'm afraid, is that ISIS is going to come back. we're going to have to do it all over again. But next time, we'll be alone.
That is a terrifying prospect, especially for Kurdish civilians. And it's not their only menace right now. Turkey and Russia are patrolling the so-called safe zone. Will Kurdish fighters and civilians drop back, or are we likely to see something like what a lot of people worried about, ethnic cleansing in this area?
They'll have at each other. I wouldn't say the Kurds will have the Turks will have the upper hand there. One of the things our people who assessed the Turkish proposed campaigns over the years to do exactly what they're trying to do now was that they wouldn't be very successful. So there may be some bloodshed and so forth. And as always in these situations, the civilians pay the worst.
I'm speaking with former Defense Secretary Ash Carter, getting his take on the situation in northern Syria. If there is widespread killings of Kurds, would the U.S. be complicit, as U.N. troops were in Rwanda in 1994, for what happens in that zone?
We won't have caused that in any event.
We will have precipitated it, though.
Well, I think we inadvertently destabilized a situation, which it didn't look like we understood what the consequences would be.
A lot of people did
understand the consequences. The whole thing about the ceasefire, I'm talking about in the government now, not outside of the government. And now we're trying to tamp down a Turkish campaign that we essentially green-lighted.
What advice would you offer U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper?
The president doesn't seem to consult his advisors and his cabinet members before he makes a decision. I therefore don't know whether the current Secretary of Defense was involved in this decision or not. Of course, that was the principal reason cited by Jim Mattis, old friend of mine and my successor as Secretary of Defense, for relinquishing his position.
You must have some thoughts on what direction Esper should be taking.
I think he's trying to preserve whatever parts of our strategic position are left there. But we really relinquished a lot of our position there. And it's not going to be possible to claw it back, nor do I think the president is going to permit the department to claw it back, even if it were possible.
Ash Carter was Secretary of Defense under President Obama from 2015 to 17. His memoir is Inside the Five-Sided Box, Lessons from a Lifetime of Leadership in the Pentagon. Secretary Carter, thank you for speaking with us again.
Really good to talk to you.
The UK has just 1 week left to get out of the European Union. Of course, deadlines have been coming and going in the Brexit saga for 3 years now. As you may recall, earlier this week, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson was trying to ram his 110-page bill through Parliament in breakneck speed. There were also 124 pages of notes. But Johnson seems to be a man of compromise.
If they genuinely want more time to study this excellent deal, they can have it, but they have to agree to a general election on December the 12th. And that's the way forward.
Got that? Members of Parliament can have more time to study the bill if they also agree to a general vote. At this point, Johnson might see a popular election as his ticket to Brexit success. The opposition party is not so keen on his new compromise. Here's the Labour Party's Valerie Vaz.
Her Majesty's opposition Labour Party will back an election once no deal is ruled out.
No deal means leaving the EU without any agreements on tariffs, migration, even basic regulations. In other words, just getting out of the EU as fast as possible. Britain's fashion industry would surely hate that. According to a trade group, 90% of fashion designers in the UK say they would prefer to remain in the European Union. The World's Orla Barry in London has more on that.
Lady Gaga and fashion. They feel a long way from Brexit and Boris Johnson. But go on an anti-Brexit march and you'll see many protesters wearing T-shirts that read Fashion Hates Brexit and Cancel Brexit. Those T-shirts were designed by Catherine Hamnett, one of the pioneers of modern British fashion. Many in the business keep their mouths shut when it comes to politics, but Hamnett is not one of them.
I really hate this whole thing. Just show me one good reason for Brexit, if you can find it anywhere, because I can't. It's just heartbreaking.
Hamnett first made front page news in 1984 at a party at Margaret Thatcher's house, the former British Prime Minister. As Hamnett turned to greet Thatcher, she opened her coat, revealing a T-shirt that read, 58% don't want Pershing. Pershing was a reference to American missiles being deployed in Europe at the time. The stunt cemented Hamlet's status as a designer and an activist. But despite all the publicity, Hamlet is not convinced that her famous T-shirts are all that politically powerful.
You know, we've got marches, we've got petitions, we've got T-shirts, but they've failed. The only thing that actually changes politicians' behaviour is something that threatens their ability to get re-elected. That's what we're trying to galvanise people to do, to actually write to their MP and say, unless you represent my views, I won't be voting for you at the next election.
The fashion industry is worth over £30 billion a year to the UK economy. That's almost $40 billion. But in the Brexit debate, politicians pay much more attention to industries like fishing.
Can she give an absolute assurance that it will be for the UK and the UK alone to determine who fishes in our national waters after a deal is signed?
And that industry adds up to only around £1.5 billion annually. Fashion employs almost as many people as the financial sector in Britain. But not many seem to be talking about what happens to this business after Brexit. Tamara Gingick is hoping to change that. She launched Fashion Roundtable after the Brexit referendum, partly as a way to lobby politicians about the needs of the industry. Many business people now say they just want a definitive decision by the UK government. But Gingick says most people in fashion want to remain part of Europe.
The people we speak to want a second referendum. I ask them the question, has your vote changed? And none of their votes have changed. But we're not hearing, we want this deal done and dusted. We're hearing, we want our voices heard. This is so bad for the UK economy that we cannot countenance just sitting by.
And do they feel that the politicians are listening to them?
No.
And it's not just about the designers. Many of the fashion students studying in the UK come from Europe. Paul Yule is a recruiter at the London College of Fashion. He says those foreign students in particular are worried about what Brexit means for their future.
We kept up a specific Brexit conversation with our students, so making sure they have right to remain or they have settled status. The amount of students we have, we've got over half of them who are in a position where it might affect them going forward.
But unlike many in the fashion business, Yule is upbeat for a few reasons.
We saw a steady increase in our applications and the quality of students that we are seeing apply to the University of the Arts, specifically London College of Fashion. And actually, the weakening of the pounds actually made it more attractive for UK to be a place or a destination for them to study.
But will they stay after graduation and after Brexit? If it ever happens, the designer Catherine Hamnett is not convinced they will.
People who live here feel like they've been dumped by a lover because they thought this was their home. I mean, I've got an assistant upstairs who's going back to Italy now.
And are they going back because of Brexit?
Yeah, there's a racism towards European now. And also they feel that the financial, economic prospects of British fashion industry where they're working are going to shrink radically under Brexit, so they'd better make a move now, you know, sooner rather than later.
Others in the industry are thinking the same thing. Tamara Gingick from Fashion Roundtable says many designers have already moved offices to other parts of Europe.
I've met with some that have entirely relocated their business. I've met some who have moved part of their business because this is an exciting creative hub. They might keep their tech teams here, but they're basically moving their logistics and, more importantly, their taxation out of the UK.
For her part, Catherine Hamnett has opened a company in Italy. She hopes it'll make her business a little more Brexit-proof. And as for that iconic T-shirt and her infamous meeting with Maggie Thatcher...
I mean, it's an early selfie. I just thought it was a photo opportunity. I mean, I had no idea that it was going to have such extraordinary longevity. You know, I just thought it was a here today, gone today. Quite funny, gotcha. It's been a kind of millstone around my neck ever since.
And for most people in the fashion industry, that's exactly how they feel about Brexit already. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Chile has woken up. In Spanish, Chile despertó. That is one of the popular chants in massive street protests throughout the South American nation this week. Most of the demonstrations have been peaceful, but there has also been vandalism and looting. Stores and subway stations have been set on fire. At least 18 people have died and more than 200 injured.
He decretado estado de emergencia en las provincias.
Last Friday, President Sebastián Piñera declared a state of emergency. He deployed military to the streets, installed a curfew in Chile's capital, Santiago, and shut down schools. Catalina May says the protests only seem to be getting bigger. She hosts a Spanish-language podcast, Las Raras. Catalina May joins us now from Santiago. I'm hearing what sounds like clanking pots and pans. Is this from the protests you went to?
Yes, definitely. That sound is non-stopping from last Friday almost. So it's happening all the time, all over the country as well.
And protests every day. What has it been like? I mean, take us to the center of these demonstrations. What have you seen?
We have two different feelings about this. There's this sense of community on the streets, you know? People are going out, using the public space, you know? And that's a nice feeling, that's good. I have been talking on the streets with all kinds of people, teachers, nurses, artists, students, lots of students on the streets. But also there's this feeling of danger and repression because we have the army around us all the time as well. For example, on a protest, I talked to Daniel Gil.
Cuéntanos cuál es tu nombre y a qué te dedicas.
Me llamo Daniel Gil y soy fotógrafo.
He's a photographer.
Hoy día estoy protestando, bueno.
When I talked to him, he said that he was protesting in solidarity with everyone's cause. Because that's the feeling, no? This is like an all kinds of people protest. So he said that people are tired of the abuse, tired of the inequality. He also says that a small percentage of Chileans live like they are in Norway, but the majority struggles to make ends meet. So you are listening to these kind of things all the time.
So protesters like Daniel see a lot of social inequality, and that reference to Norway, there are a lot of people in the 1% in Chile that he's not happy about.
Absolutely. People feel like this is the moment to show that they are not willing to keep living like they are living. Chile is a really unequal society. According to numbers of the World Bank, we have a 1% of people who are getting 33% of the incomes of the richness. So people know that and they feel it and they actually live it every day. And they are tired and they don't want to have this anymore.
Porque ellos tienen la voz y empezaron esto.
I also talked to Ana Huerta. She was with her daughter and also her husband was there. So it was like a family protest for them. And she said to me that she is protesting for her daughter, because her daughter is actually in debt because of her student loan. So that's one of the reasons. She also said to me that she lived during the dictatorship, so she was afraid at the beginning of all of this. But she said, we are not afraid anymore. We are not hiding like rats anymore. That's what she said.
So I've heard a lot of concern about the presence of military in the streets and police, that people in Chile have not seen this since the 17-year dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. That ended in 1990. I mean, how significant is that?
It was very surprising because the government already recognized that 18 people have died during these days, and the National Institution of Human Rights said that 5 of those people were killed by the military. So that's happening now in this country. It's hard to believe, really.
Catalina May lives in Santiago, Chile, where she's the host of the Spanish language podcast Las Raras, or The Outsiders. Catalina, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much. We are happy to let the world know what's happening here.
Leonardo da Vinci gets credit for a lot of inventions, the calculator and parachutes. He even invented an instrument. That's his viola organ. Da Vinci also wanted to add a really, really long bridge to his list. In 1502, he proposed one to connect two neighborhoods in what is modern Istanbul. It would have been the longest bridge in the world, but the Ottoman Sultan rejected it, and the bridge was never built. Until now, a team of researchers at MIT built a scale model of the bridge to see if Da Vinci's plan would have worked. Spoiler alert here, it would have. Engineer Carly Bast led the study. So you only had a sketch of the bridge and Da Vinci's letter to the Sultan, but Da Vinci did not specify what the bridge would have been made of. What were the options that you had at your disposal, and how did you decide what Da Vinci most likely would have used?
So the shape kind of guided us. There are wood bridges in similar shapes, but most likely it would have been stone or brick. The brick just wouldn't have been strong enough. There is no mortar. There's nothing reinforcing this. It's just the stone held together by compression.
Why did the Sultan turn it down?
You know, when you build something, you look at what has been done before, to kind of validate what you're going to do. But this is something that would have been about 10 times longer than any span at the time. So I think this structure makes sense and it works. But in reality, when you're going to build something, there are a lot of other factors to look at, economy, construction. And I think those would have posed some complicated challenges for them.
So you ended up printing 3D blocks, assembling them on top of scaffolding, which is how it was done in Da Vinci's time. It took you 6 hours to 3D print each block. There were 126 of them, and it initially took you an hour to put them all together. Then you take the scaffolding out. It's kind of the Jenga moment. How worried were you that all that hard work would just kind of fall apart?
I was incredibly worried. I assembled it similar to how you would assemble a masonry bridge. So you start from the ends and then you kind of come towards the top. And when you put the last piece in, you can sort of feel you have to squeeze the piece because the geometry is perfect. When you take the scaffolding out, you realize that, oh my, this thing is standing. And so you can imagine after months of printing, it was like, wow. And of course, I was in the basement of our lab alone at like 3 o'clock in the morning and was just celebrating alone.
I got to say, you still sound kind of surprised that it happened.
I am.
So your construction, your model was successful. How does Da Vinci's design compare to modern bridges? I mean, is this something that could be put into place today?
The form is not something far off from forms that you see now. But what's different is the material. We have more advanced materials like steel and reinforced concrete. So I don't think it's realistic that the bridge would have been built today, but I would say that the form is something you can kind of recognize now.
What you were able to do with Da Vinci's design, I mean, is this just another example of how ahead of his time he was?
Yeah, I think you're not really able to confine Leonardo da Vinci to one label. He's not an artist and he's not a scientist. It just sort of shows how unbounded he was by any discipline.
Carly Bast, a recent graduate of MIT's Civil and Environmental Engineering Master's Program, who has reproduced Leonardo da Vinci's design for a 1502 bridge. Carly, thank you very much for explaining this all to us.
Thank you very much, Marco, for your time. I appreciate it.
We have Leonardo's original sketch and a photo of the bridge that MIT built, both on our Instagram feed. We are at PRI The World. Foreign workers have poured into Qatar to build soccer stadiums for the next World Cup, and they sign contracts that bind them to their bosses. Some call it sponsorship, others call it slavery.
And then they ended up having to work for long hours, sometimes with delay in their salary, in very dire living conditions.
How Qatar plans to do better, that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. The Men's Soccer World Cup is the most popular sporting event on Earth. It happens every 4 years. It's a chance for the host country to step into the international spotlight. The Gulf nation of Qatar plays host next, but with prestige also comes responsibility, and for Qatar, that means addressing workers' rights. The Royal's Shirin Jafari reports.
The winner to organize the 2022 FIFA World Cup is Qatar.
Qatar won its bid to host the 2022 World Cup. That announcement came back in 2010. It was a historic moment for this nation of 2.6 million people. Qatar became the first Middle Eastern country picked to host a soccer tournament. But it was great news, too, for people from countries like Nepal, Bangladesh, and the Philippines. Thousands of job-seeking men and women saw Qatar as a place to find work and a chance to lift their families out of poverty. Many took that chance. In the span of 8 years, Qatar's population doubled.
We're talking about more than 2 million migrant workers.
Sharon Barrow heads the International Trade Union Confederation. The group calls itself a global voice for workers. She says migrant workers now make up 95% of Qatar's workforce.
That's, of course, been largely due to a construction boom, but you're also seeing massive increases in hospitality and events management.
Job seekers are often willing to do whatever it takes to get to Qatar, says May Romanos. She's with Amnesty International and researches migrant workers' rights in the Persian Gulf countries.
They have to buy this job, they tell you. They take up loans. Sometimes they just also let go their properties to come, hoping to get some money and a better future for their kids.
But Romano says when the workers get to Qatar, the reality can be very different from what they were promised.
Most of the time, they were promised a different salary from what they have. They are promised different working conditions. And then they different also labor accommodations. And then they ended up having to work for long hours, sometimes with delay in their salary, in very dire living conditions.
What makes their situation even worse, she says, is that workers cannot quit their jobs. They also cannot leave the country without approval from their bosses. They are, in effect, bound to their employers through a system called kafala.
Kafala is the sponsorship program. Basically, for a migrant worker to come to Qatar to work, they need to be sponsored by a company.
Hutan Homayunpour heads the UN's International Labour Organization in Qatar.
And once they come here, that kafala or the sponsorship program means that if they want to leave the country temporarily or permanently, they would need to get an exit permit from their employer.
Homayunpour says the system has led to abuse.
When you need your employer's approval to change your job, when you need your employer's approval to leave the country, then your negotiation position is much weaker and also your mobility is controlled by the employer.
In the years since the World Cup announcement, Qatar has been under international scrutiny for the way it treats its foreign workers. Its response has been slow. But last week, there were signs of change. The International Labour Organization said Qatar is implementing a series of reforms to its labour laws. Here's UN official Hutan Homayunpour again.
When workers are here, if they want to change their employer, they can do so with giving the standard advance notice, just like in any other country. Also, if they want to leave temporarily or permanently the state of Qatar, they would no longer be required to obtain an exit permit.
Qatar's government has not yet approved all of these changes, but Homayunpour expects them to be in place by January. May Romanos of Amnesty International says the proposed changes do sound promising. The question is how they are implemented.
We have seen this promise before, and it didn't really materialize with something big. It was in 2015, same announcement were made, and actually it was just a rebranding of the system and not much has changed.
This time it does help, she says, that the UN Labour Organization has an office in Qatar and that it can keep an eye on how the reforms are being carried out.
We will continue to monitor, we will continue to document the human rights situation, speak with workers and listen to their stories and see if actually there is improvement in their rights.
She says if the reforms do turn out to be successful in Qatar, they can be a model for other countries in the region that have similar abusive labor laws. It could also send a message to the future hosts of the Soccer World Cup that they need to respect the rights of workers. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted a massive Africa summit this week. It just wrapped up in Sochi, host city for the 2014 Winter Olympics. Leaders from every African nation were present, including 40 heads of state. Many trade deals involving arms and oil went down. Georgi Undurangu from the BBC's Africa Business Unit is there in Sochi. So it seems pretty wild there. Just paint us a picture of the sights and sounds of this conference, if you would.
So Vladimir Putin sat across numerous African leaders, putting pen to paper. One by one they came, and one by one some signed contracts and some had a major news that came out of those particular meetings.
Russia exerting its influence on African leaders, making deals, lots of weapons deals, I understand. There was even a virtual gun range for some hands-on experience. What was that about?
Now, to just show you the kind of power or the kind of showcase they were doing and to exert what they meant, this is the kind of business we mean. Right at the entrance to the summit, they had trucks, they had latest tech, they had gadgets, military equipment. Right at the entrance where the delegates were coming in, basically when you come in, you see exactly what Russia is about.
So does it seem to you that basically Russia is trying to sell lots of weapons to Africa and not much else?
No, that's not it. It's because they've had success with that. They're touting that as part of the other sectors that they're interested in. So food exports is one. Grains is another. Infrastructure development is another. They've discussed nuclear technology as well. Not nuclear warfare, but nuclear technology and nuclear research centers in different countries. So the list of things that have been discussed over the last 2 days is phenomenal. We haven't seen anything of such magnitude, at least with Russia in the same sentence.
What kind of vision does Vladimir Putin have for Russia's future relationship with the continent? Is there a clear strategy?
Yes, there is a very clear strategy. So what he wants to do is that he wants Russia to be synonymous with change and synonymous with progress on the African continent. Now, we've seen what's been happening. Africa is definitely the place to be right now. Russia has shown that they're very deliberate in what they're listening to. They're very deliberate in what ideas are presented on the table. And you could see even the body language of Vladimir Putin, he was trying to listen and understand what every country wanted to bring to the table so that they know how Russia can help.
Russia getting involved more deeply in Africa makes me wonder about how their approach shapes up compared to, say, China, which has a major presence on the continent, or the U.S. What can you tell us about that?
That's actually a very fantastic question, because there was a very deliberate announcement that was made, which was that Russia has debt relief for some countries. What that means is they wipe off debts and they're able to, say, start off on a clean slate on different projects. Now, when this was announced today, it was to the tune of $20 billion that Russia would wipe off debt to the tune of $20 billion for different African countries. The difference between them and China, for example, whenever you're unable to pay, they come and they recoup their money through taking up some of the state utilities.
So China, it sounds, just seizes the assets. Russia will cancel the country's debts. I mean, Russia is not a rich country. Can it really afford to do that?
Exactly. And that's exactly what has caused some bit of commotion here. I mean, some kind of murmurs, because the Russians here are saying, or the analysts here, they're saying, we don't have the same financial muscle as Beijing. We don't have the same financial muscle as America. How are you relieving $20 billion of debt of stuff that we invested in? But it's pretty clear the fact that Putin himself came and said that they have short, medium and long term projects, and they're very sure that they will recoup their money.
Georgi Indurangu with the BBC's Africa Business Unit in Sochi, Russia, for the Russia-Africa Summit. Thank you very much.
Thank you as well.
In South Korea, body art is big, and Korean tattoos are admired the world over. So you might find it surprising to learn that tattooing is still largely illegal in Korea. Here's Kelly Kasulis in Seoul.
I'm looking for a tattoo parlor here in Itaewon, a neighborhood in Seoul. After a few minutes of searching, I find the sign. It says Sunny Ink Studio.
So we're about to walk into this tattoo parlor. It's in the basement over here.
Tattoo parlors are everywhere in the city, and they're pretty easy to find. That's why I was surprised to hear that tattooing is actually illegal in Korea. When I walk in, I don't see a place that's trying to hide.
Yeah, it's really, like, nice and classy in here and not like what you would expect from like an underground tattoo studio.
Han Tae-sun, the studio's owner, shows me around. For a tattoo artist, he's not exactly inked up.
I don't have many tattoos, like unlike other tattoo designers, but the reason why I don't like getting hurt, basically. I don't like painful things.
Han got into the tattoo game 7 years ago. To him, tattoos may be an illegal industry, but they're still good business, especially since he doesn't have to pay taxes. In 1992, the South Korean government passed a law that said only medical professionals or doctors could legally give tattoos, since it involves puncturing the skin.
Giving a tattoo is just like a painting a picture and selling to somebody, but applying those medical laws to the tattoo, it just doesn't make sense to me.
Han says keeping tattoo parlors illegal sends the message that body art is bad for society. For a long time, South Koreans believed that only gangsters got tattoos, but that idea is fading as body art becomes more popular. Han's friend once got a tattoo removed just to get a job.
The day before the getting interview, he went to the plastic surgeon and said, I want this tattoo to be off my arm. So he actually cut his skin off so he could actually get into this job eventually.
The stigma around tattoos is pushing other artists to protest. Song Gang-sup is with the Korea Tattoo Association. I find him in an empty warehouse he calls his office. He has been organizing protests here, calling for new laws that will license tattoo artists who aren't doctors. So far, the government hasn't responded.
We thought that after just 5 years of protesting that tattoos are going to be legalized in Korea, but it hasn't happened. So we're tired. We're tired of this whole process.
Song says that there are thousands of tattoo artists working in South Korea, and so the number of people receiving illegal tattoos must be even larger. It's not just South Koreans getting tattoos here either. Stephanie Lackney is an American English teacher here in Seoul. She only has Korean tattoos. What's special about Korean tattoos?
For the Korean tattoo aesthetic, they really like to keep it very dainty in a way. So you can have these really intricate designs that have a lot of detail and are drawn with very fine lines. Meanwhile, in the States, we have the American old school style, which is very thick lines. That is very blocky, kind of what you think when you think of a biker's gang. So it's complete opposite of what we have.
Stephanie is one of the millions of people following Korean tattoo artists online for their distinctive style. But no matter how famous they are, Korean tattoo artists aren't safe from the law. Just a few months ago, police raided Song's studio and shut it down at random.
경찰도 고객이 많아요. 있는데.
It's almost like it depends on the police officer. If they feel like enforcing the law, then they're going to enforce it. If they don't feel like enforcing it, then they don't.
Song still isn't sure why his studio was targeted, but he thinks an angry customer must have complained. It's rare for tattoo artists to lose their studios to raids, he says, and they usually end up moving shop to another part of town. But Song isn't sure if he wants to start over or just move on. For the World, Kelly Casulis, Seoul.
In Spain today, the corpse of a dictator has been exhumed and moved more than 40 years after his death. It was a helicopter that transported the remains of General Francisco Franco to avoid protests. Franco presided over a dark and painful time in Spain. Franco led an uprising that started the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s. More than 500,000 people died. Franco emerged victorious and led the country until his death in 1975. He was laid to rest in a giant ornate mausoleum, the Valley of the Fallen. Julio Gomariz was once imprisoned by Franco.
So why should have Franco treated in different way? He was a war criminal.
Franco's burial site has been debated in Spain for decades. His grave has become a shrine for the far right. Spain's current socialist government moved Franco's body because they felt it was wrong to glorify the Franco era. Franco's family opposed today's move, but many in Spain do not think the dictator deserves a mausoleum. Fernando Martinez Lopez is the director of the Franco Exhumation Project. Lopez says that by removing Franco's body from the Valley of the Fallen, it makes Spain's democracy stronger. It's not about turning the page, he says. It's about making things right. Franco is being reburied in a more low-key grave next to his late wife in Madrid. We hear a lot about the major risks associated with climate change, drought, rising seas, stronger hurricanes, and risks to biodiversity with all the changing weather patterns. Climate change also poses a lot of financial risk, and investors are putting increasing pressure on corporations, demanding more transparency around those risks. But as the world's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler reports, most companies have yet to respond.
You can think about the financial risks from climate change as coming from a couple of different directions. There's the direct cost from changing weather, like drought-stricken crops and flooded factories. Then there's the cost of addressing climate change. Jean-Francois Mercure at the University of Exeter gives this example.
Okay, well, imagine that electric vehicles become more and more popular. Now, if that starts to really become big, and many vehicles become electric.
Say because countries subsidize them to cut emissions, or people just get really into their Teslas and Priuses.
That makes a lot of fuel that's not consumed anymore. And that means that the reserves of fuel that we have around the world perhaps some of them might never be extracted and never be sold.
That would be a good thing for the climate, and it could reduce weather-related costs to the economy. But it would also mean a financial hit for the companies that own those reserves. Mercure estimated they represent between $1 and $4 trillion in possible losses.
And this is effectively all these reserves of oil, gas, and coal that are invested in but never sold.
Now, you may be thinking, that doesn't affect me. I don't own stock in energy companies. But it's likely that your retirement account or mutual fund does have holdings in those companies. Carol Muffett is head of the Center for International and Environmental Law. He says the people in charge of those big pots of money are starting to demand more information about the risks that specific companies face, both from climate policies and directly from climate change itself.
The investing community, which is often inherently conservative, is beginning to recognize that it has to assess these risks. And, you know, particularly for large-scale institutional investors at pension funds, there are fiduciary duties to do so.
For at least the last 10 or so years, energy giant ExxonMobil has responded to investor pressure and incorporated risk related to climate regulations into its investment decisions. But now the company's on trial in New York for allegedly misleading investors about how it was estimating that risk. This lack of transparency extends all across the global financial system, says sustainable finance expert Michael Zimani.
We are not clear about the impacts of climate change to the financial system, and so we need more information.
He's advocating for companies to disclose climate-related financial risks so investors can make informed decisions. That was a key recommendation from a 2017 report by a special task force.
The reason that this task force was set up is not an environmental ethical reason.
It was established by a group of G20 central bankers
that sees climate change as a potential risk to financial stability as a whole.
Their worry is that sudden losses associated with climate change could trigger a financial crisis like the one we faced in 2008. In fact, the task force was set up by the same financial stability board established after the mortgage crisis. Zimoni says it's hard to say exactly how big the financial risk posed by climate change is.
But the fact that the same body is looking at climate risk as the body that looked at the 2008 financial crisis might indicate something.
2 years ago, the Financial Task Force published recommendations urging companies to voluntarily disclose how much climate change could cost them and their investors. But so far, it says only a tiny minority of companies are actually doing that. Sustainable finance experts say these kinds of disclosures will have to be made mandatory for that to change. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Lunch, for many of us, is that moment in the day where food can briefly transport us out of our routines. In Norway, though, the flagship lunch is a sandwich known as matpakke, a sandwich that doesn't have a lot going for it. But that's kind of its selling point.
Our food culture is not based on very strong taste at all.
That's Ronald Sagatun. He runs a YouTube channel about Norwegian culture called Your Way to Norway. He explains that you don't need a lot to make matpakke. First, you start with a few slices of rye or wheat bread. Then come the toppings, starting with tube cheese.
Where you have soft, smooshy cheese on a tube looking like a toothpaste tube. Then you can also choose liver pate, but you also have a fish variant of this. You use fish liver and roe. Actually, that's my favorite.
Yummy. Then you stack the layers and separate each layer with wax paper. Just don't go too crazy with the layers.
Two or three, not more. If you, like, have four open sandwiches, people will like, oh, whoa.
Matpakke's main appeal, it's practical, like Norwegians. It doesn't take much time to make or to eat. It's also affordable. Flashing your wealth in Norway is a big no-no. Thriftiness is a virtue there.
That's a signal that we are all equal and we eat the same, we go to the same public schools, and even the prince and the princess of Norway probably have matpakke.
If it's good enough for the royals, everyone should enjoy matpakke. But even Sagatun admits eating matpakke did not come easy. His father is Sami, an indigenous group in the far north of Europe, and his mother is from Chile.
Neither of these backgrounds are Norwegian, and my whole life I've had to learn how to be a real or proper Norwegian.
That meant eating like one. When he was young, his mother cooked him beautiful, fresh lunches. The other kids at school, they didn't get it.
They were like, what is it? What kind of people are you? You were looked down upon and so on. So I came home to my mom and said, no, you cannot make it. My grandmother has to make matake, or what I did to learn to make it myself. So when I went to school, I wouldn't be stared at or bullied by the other kids.
Bullied because of what you have in your lunchbox. Now that he's older, Sagatun enjoys matpakya, but doesn't feel he has to eat it. He works at an ad agency in Oslo that has a well-stocked cafeteria, although he says his co-workers, even with that abundance of choice, they usually go for the matpakya.
Today we had risotto at my work, and most of my co-workers, they put a little bit of risotto on their plate, just beside their two open slice sandwiches with this no-tasting cheese.
Risotto paired with tasteless cheese? Don't tell Italy. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.